Hi, and welcome to the Ryle Books podcast. Today, I'm delighted to be able to share with you the recording of the launch of Exocapitalism, Economies with Absolutely No Limits, by the authors Roberto Alonso Trillo and Marek Pollix. The launch took place at our space in Brussels on the 9th of October, 2025. I'm just going to briefly introduce the book to you and introduce our guests before we start to play the recording for you. Exocapitalism was published by Becoming Press in 2025. At the centre of Marek Pollix and Roberto Alonso Trillo's argument is the idea that capital does not belong to humans. It belongs to and is governed by itself. Traditional economic theory struggles to keep up with the rapid rate of acceleration, and this book steps in to address this. And I quote, "The critical orthodoxy is slowing. It's tired. It's not especially good at the internet. It's probably never manned a Starbucks counter or anonymous cubicle. Its younger adepts, though digitally native, are chronically underemployed, unavailable, and drowned in the student debt that is required for the entry into the critical apparatus. Few have any patience for the numbing slop-speak of the LinkedIn economy, the libertarian enclave of Forex and HFT and meme coins, the blazingly random mood swings of venture capital that lubricate all of the above. This impatience is, in the parlance of the above, a blocker. It means that the critical apparatus underestimates the power of the software economy, struggles to articulate the morphological density of digitally realized capitalism, comprehensively ignores the functional death of labor, and it does not understand scale." Marek Pollix is a researcher in the philosophy of technology, especially with respect to deep learning. He's based in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Marek and his primary research partner, Roberto, who is in conversation with tonight, have been working to situate deep learning tools as endosymbiotic reproductive infrastructure, or rather, inorganic vehicles through which biological, epistemological, and social information is encoded, subject to contingent processes and transmitted. Roberto Alonso Trillo is a theorist and artist whose work spans cultural theory, media philosophy, and experimental sound. Based in Hong Kong, his research engages the aesthetic and political dimensions of machine learning, with particular attention to infrastructural critique and performativity. He is in an ongoing collaboration with Marek Pollix. So the two authors here tonight are going to read from the book and then enter into a discussion to unfold some of its propositions. Thanks so much for listening to the podcast. We hope you enjoy.
So shall we just kick it off? Or yeah? Okay, sweet. Thank you so much to Ryle Books for having us. Absolutely. What an amazing bookstore. Wow. It's, I'm just like thrilled to be represented here in a number of different ways. The book is here. I want to specifically shout out Becoming Press, who are in the back, who are truly the best publishers. Like, they're incredible. I strongly recommend supporting them in any way you can. It doesn't even mean that you have to support us, because they also have other books here, which are also amazing. So regardless how you feel about us, I still very much recommend supporting this amazing group of people who really made something, I think, quite difficult to do, which is essentially put together and release a book in about 6 months, a possibility. And that's really difficult to do. And yeah, I'm just so excited about it. So yeah, I think maybe the way to contextualize this is we're going to give a talk for like an hour. I hope that's okay. It's going to be fine. Like, it'll be a good talk, I think. But we're tired. This is the last leg of our tour. So we're going to try and give you every little bit that we have. And then we might just shut down. But we will make room for questions at the end as well. And hopefully we can hang out a little bit and chat in that capacity. Is there anything else you want to add?
No, I think... Let's do it.
Let's do it.
Go for it, man.
This is the last. Oh my God! I get to go home tomorrow and hug my baby. Roberto gets to go back to Hong Kong, but it's good to be here tonight. So maybe we're here representing a book called Exocapitalism, maybe you know, for anyone who hasn't read the book, which I assume is most people, I'd like to talk about what it is that we're trying to do as an initial framing. Then we're going to talk about one core concept from the book. Which is really, we're going to spend literally an hour just talking about chapter two, but there's many other chapters in the book, so it kind of enmeshes into a complex system. and we'll give many examples. So I think the goal today is to talk about a concept and give a lot of different examples about it. So the book is called Exocapitalism, and the exo in exocapitalism, of course, means from the outside, right? From without, from the exterior. And ultimately, what we're trying to accomplish with the exo is to build a general theory of capitalism, which means we're doing this through ontology and not through the social sciences. We're proposing capitalism as a kind of being or a form, a kind of object, an alien in the most literal sense, something that looks and feels like an algorithm, something that might have come from elsewhere, something that can be generalized and applied elsewhere, something that might be, let's say, actualized, like made real or made actual or made material, materialized by humans throughout our history, but something that very well could have been actualized or materialized differently by other things that aren't humans, according to the same axiomatic logic. And really, the exo here, the intensity of the exo and exocapitalism, is the question, what happens if capitalism is transcendental? What if it could really exist without us, even before us, or irrespective of our involvement with it? What if capitalism is a bundle of formal principles deeply related to things like abstraction, representation, language, even mathematics in some way? And we're not necessarily suggesting that it's any of those things necessarily, but maybe it's potentially part of a class that contains those things. It's like a sibling of those particular objects. Things that we actualize, again, as humans, in local and specific ways, but things that feel like they could happen elsewhere. And because of this, we really suggest that capitalism might be a very, very deep situation. And there's a lot of people, people that we love, people I assume actually quite a lot of people in this crew love, like Mark Fisher, for example, or Ursula K. Le Guin, who is my favorite, who suggests that the capitalism that we live in is every bit as arbitrary as any other regime of social organization and is therefore exchangeable, perhaps even easily so. That maybe the obstacle for us is to just understand the simple arbitrariness of our condition and then kind of give ourselves the permission or afford ourselves the imaginative capacity to imagine an alternative, perhaps by looking backwards to the past and recognizing the great diversity of social systems that came before the present moment, maybe even specifically, of course, by looking outside of the West. But we look at that proposition, which feels reasonable, and we want to ask ourselves the underlying question, which is like, is capitalism really arbitrary? We give ourselves the luxury of defining capitalism a little differently than most people do, where instead of looking only at industrial scale surplus value extraction and conventional labor exploitation as situated primarily within the West, we have our eyes rather on a much broader history through which there exists some automatic generation of capital from capital. The Marxian M to M prime equation, money to more money, as the most important bit of what we are calling capitalism. And taking a look at this, it seems like a lot of the particularly interesting, powerful, problematic, intense characteristics of the present can also be found in the deeper past, and certainly across the entire globe. Looking at the Andean caravan trade, the Parthian Silk Road, the Champagne Fairs, the cowrie shell trade, both in China and on the west coast of Africa. And that maybe, in this context, it's worth asking ourselves if capitalism is a deeper problem than we might think it is. That imagining ourselves out of it might not just involve rejecting some kind of ideological conditioning, but it might involve a deeper cut or a deeper sacrifice than we might expect. I mean, it really does seem like in the Han Dynasty in the 2nd century BC, there was already a struggle to contain, to control the rampant arbitrage practices of salt merchant middlemen. And one of the provocations with the book is that already just with language, you find yourself potentially trapped in the cancerous loops of capitalism simply through the process of elevation from a referent into a surplus of representational positions. You might inadvertently begin a cycle that leads all the way to high frequency trading. This isn't to suggest that this condition is inescapable, but rather that the concision requires better targeting, much, much, much better targeting than the targeting we have right now, in order for that work of excision and removal to be productive.
It feels like the tools we developed to make sense of capitalism don't work anymore. Maybe they did at one point. We refer usually to this example of when Marx was examining the official British factory inspectors' reports in the 1830s and 40s. That's the first book of Capital. And then maybe capitalism changed. Or maybe capitalism died, or maybe it permuted into something that became unrecognizable as capitalism. And to us, that's totally reasonable. Once the tools have stopped working and the kind of you stop making sense of capitalism, and what you find is the kind of end date of normal capitalism and the start date of this new special insurgent post-capitalism, they keep changing. Yeah. So what is the right date? I mean, is it after Fordism? Is it after Bretton Woods? Is it after the Asian Tigers, the dot-com, the 2008 crisis? Is it after Silicon Valley, the BRICS? Like, when did this new capitalism start? And from these, we get to three key questions that we will try to address today to some extent. The first one being, is it useful to fragment capitalism into all of these new but quickly obsolete forms? A second one that is linked to this one would be, is it useful to always consider the present moment as a state of exception, as a kind of radical departure, if you want? And finally, is it really enough to make sense of capitalism by systematizing one or two of its expressions, by shrinking it down into its apperception, into the kind of human scales, human experience of things? And our argument today, and in general in the book, is that it is not, that the answer is no to all of these questions. It doesn't make sense. So instead of splitting capitalism into old industrial classical capitalism, which, if you want, is the capitalism that makes sense to us, the capitalism that we can explain, that we have developed tools for, and then a new capitalism, and then you can choose the name. Yeah, I'm sure we could ask everyone here, you know, name what new capitalism may or may not be. You can think of late stage, end stage, cognitive, algorithmic, financial, speculative, platform, surveillance, techno-capitalism. And if you've read Varoufakis, you can even say techno-feudalism if you want. But what we're trying to do is to zoom deep into capitalism and find something that feels essential, something that feels germinal, something that feels consistent throughout, regardless of the acceleration or intensity with which those underlying mechanics might be applied at any given point in time. We think that we found a framework for these essential mechanics, and this framework has been really useful for us. At very least, you know, it's helping us not only to cope with capital, but also to kind of predict its moves in a way. And we want to talk about one of those mechanics today, which is a function or a tendency within capitalism that we call lift. The talk today is all about lift. As Marek was pointing out before, it's the second chapter of the book, but it's an expanded version of that. And there are other similarly kind of critical concepts in the book. If you've read it, drag, fold, scale, last mile. But we want to stick to lift today just to keep things tight and clean.
So yeah, we're talking about lift, and we're giving a bunch of different examples of lift. But maybe to kind of start really basically, if I was to give an elevator pitch for what lift means, I'd say that lift is the drive that compels capitalism toward abstraction and away from production. But to be more passionate about it, I could double down and suggest that not only is capitalism allergic to production, but capitalism is further allergic to the feedback loop of consumption and production in general. And moreover, that it's allergic to making things, selling things, buying things, distributing things, and organizing things. And further, that it's allergic to any kind of physical media whatsoever. And even more importantly, that it's actively disinterested in sustaining any direct entanglements with physical media in any respect, humans included, period. And I don't mean disinterested or allergic in a kind of psychoanalytical sense, because in exocapitalism, there's no psychoanalytical subject. We're not talking about like a kind of ghost that's like emerging from the human consciousness. Instead, when I say disinterested or allergic, I really mean this in an algorithmic sense, that the cascading self-abstraction away from material conditions isn't just what capitalism does, it's actually what capitalism is. And the away part of this equation is what we call lift.
So we're going to discuss Lyft today, and it's going to get weirder and weirder.
Yeah, it's going to get really weird.
Over the next hour. But we're going to start simple with the first kind of Lyft, the most kind of basic and fundamental, which is what we call tokenization. And essentially, that this implies is the lift of a physical good into exchange value, the elevation of a thing into money. And this is something that we came to understand by reading David Graeber's book, Debt, the First 5,000 Years, which smashes this idealized image of barter systems that we usually link to ancient societies. What Graeber points out is that there were not economies just based on, hey, give me some milk and I'll give you some eggs. It didn't work that way. Those systems were always bound to some idea of money. There always existed some prior framework for respective egg-to-milk pricing. And once you have money, once you have exchange value, something interesting happens. An egg becomes more than an egg. It enters into dynamic, a turbulent web of relationships. The idea that the egg can become worth more or less, not only in terms of milk, but also in a broader, a more general sense based on the size of that monetary system and the things that it contains. So what happens to us is that the egg lifts into virtual eggness. It becomes addressable as a point in a coordinate system of exchange value, and it becomes an abstraction as a result. And once one monetary system encounters another monetary system, another kind of lift occurs. There needs to exist a larger marketplace of exchange that contains and mediates their mutual relationships. This coin on this monetary system, on this currency, needs to be exchangeable with that coin on that other currency through a higher level or higher system of exchange that contains them both and modulates their respective exchange values.
So hopefully it's clear the kind of structure that we're implying here. So like egg lifts into kind of virtual eggness as it enters into the exchange value relationship with milk, right? So you have this first order kind of lift into a virtual space. Then let's say this particular community encounters another community that has their own respective egg and milk or whatever pricing. As these two marketplaces engage with each other through some kind of currency relationship, another kind of market appears on top, right? You have a kind of Matryoshka doll of marketplaces. And this gets super weird and complicated very quickly because you can actually always just invent a new monetary system. And it's actually really totally possible that this new invented space might spontaneously acquire a connection to real value. So, I mean, a great example of this is something like a carbon credit. That's an artificial monetary system built entirely on regulation. So I'm sure you know the company Tesla. Tesla makes Tesla's a huge company with a ton of revenue behind it. It makes 40% of its revenue by selling the carbon credits that it earns from the United States government for complying with this or that regulatory principle back to other automakers who have not yet been able to accomplish that regulatory compliance. 40% of revenue of Tesla is a massive amount of money. It's like an unthinkable amount of money. Place that in discourse with the other things that Tesla does, and you start to see a very weird company that's mostly built on abstract tokenization and not on cars. Think about bells in Animal Crossing or gold in Dota 2, or shinies in Pokemon Go. And there's really a correlation there. All of these are, you know, in-game, abstract, currency-like objects that then collide with fiat money in an unstable way via auctions on eBay or Facebook Marketplace. Or think about Star Alliance loyalty points, which collide with fiat money through their relationship to MasterCard and then intermediary banks like Barclays and other weird token systems that kind of prolapse from this environment, like credit card points or miles. And as each of these systems of exchange collides with each other, they merge into higher order marketplaces through which their turbulent, constantly changing exchange rates are mediated. So I want to talk about what we think is the fundamental mechanic of capitalism, which is the technique or the technology called arbitrage. So arbitrage is a very fundamental and simple thing. It essentially means, like, let's say I have some gold. It's worth this much in Paris. I know that it's worth actually more than that in London. So long as it is cheaper for me to take that gold from Paris to London and bring it back into the market, I essentially have a kind of free money machine, right? I can just go and continually move gold from Paris to London. This is arbitrage. It basically means the fact that the exploitation of the fact that there exists some disjuncture in price. And what's interesting is that in arbitrage, like, markets hate arbitrage. Markets are all about equilibration. They're all about negentropy. They're trying to stabilize price relationships. So what you have in the kind of fundamental operations of capitalism is the problematics of real ontological difference between two places, two ideas, two locations, and then an equilibrating mechanism constantly operating in this recursive way on top of each other. So the problem is that, you know, you can't just stop at this individual kind of gold marketplace between London and Paris, because at a certain point that price is going to regulate because enough gold will have moved to Paris. Instead, what you need to do in order to continue to engage in arbitrage sustainably is to build higher and higher and higher marketplaces that allow you to bring in more and more things with less stability associated with them. So the higher you go from a physical asset like gold to money, to crypto, to meta crypto, to meta crypto, to bundled ETFs, to derivatives and meta derivatives and everything on top of that stack, the easier it is to conduct arbitrage, because all the underlying inconsistencies in price, as expressed through their volatility, cascade upwards. Things become more volatile, more random, and more lucrative to the arbitrageur. So that's lift one, tokenization.
So second type of lift that we wanted to introduce today is the movement from hardware economics to software economics. That is the movement from commodities to services. So the underpinning idea here is that you can only extract so much profit from a physical commodity. Yes, you need to make it out of stuff. It needs to be formed by people. And then you need to move it around in space. All of those operations cost money, and they can only get that cheap. You can buy, if you want, as many raw materials as you want, but you're limited by the raw materials on planet Earth. Even if you go elsewhere to different planets, you might find a limitation there. You can slave labor as much as you like, but you're always limited by local laws and at the end of the day by the reproducibility of your labor force. You can optimize logistics as much as possible, but at the end of the day, again, you have ports, tariffs, bribes, and fuel that need to be paid for. And unfortunately, the price on the commodity you're trying to sell is limited by its conceivable demand. You can only charge that much. And the differential between the cost of the good you've made and the price you're selling it for, what we would call the profit margin, is limited. You're kind of stuck with a price, yes? You cannot make up a price. Now, for so much theory downstream of Marx, this is the world space of capitalism. Commodities marketplaces operating under extreme price constraints, where the only way that the profit can be generated is by trying to squeeze your production costs, and I guess we agree here, at the end of the day, by stealing from your workers, right? So theory downstream of Marx interprets capitalism as a social dynamic, through which capitalists and working classes sustain a holy struggle, and against which the worker class is not only subject to exploitation, but also psyop. Deep social and psychological engineering that make the terms of exploitation seem reasonable to the worker class. Now, we call commodities economics hardware economics. You're dealing with something that is physical, it needs to be assembled out of raw materials, and it needs to be moved around the world. And you can only make those conditions so cheap before you actually hit a wall. But software economics is not really like that. Software margins are incredibly supple and elastic. Yes, you do need software engineers, but as software businesses grow up, most of those functions become more or less automatic. Software economics, this is an important argument here, is all about resale. So software businesses lease property that already exists. They package it all together with a little bit of the sauce, and then they sell it back at a significant markup. Most, to us, software engineering software, is not creative labor. It's not even intellectual labor. It's a low overhead maintenance operation that concerns itself principally with the management of integrations between different pre-existing third-party software ecosystems. At scale, the flaws on software margins are not driven by the intellectual labor of software engineers or totally fungible front of house or back desk work. They are actually driven by the price of compute, which at the end of the day is driven by the price of energy. If there is surplus value generated in the software economy, it's not extracted from human labor qua labor, but from the compute-mediated arbitrage of energy and its distribution. And the big problem here is that energy is still really, really, really cheap, catastrophically cheap.
So things start to get really weird here, because it follows that if essentially you're just limited by the price of energy, and the price of energy is catastrophically cheap, Software can basically have any price. It really doesn't matter because the main variable component at scale, again, is compute power, which ultimately drains down to the level of maybe some hardware capex and ultimately utilities payments. And sure, there's a market determined ceiling on how much you can charge for software, but software profits commonly, on average, like even on median, exceed over 80% over costs, 80% markup. That's crazy. That's crazy. 80% markup. Like, I hope it's like clear to this group how nuts it is to continually charge 80% increments on essentially a continuous resale operation. It's imaginary. It's fiction. The price is literally made up. And this is what excites what we call exocapitalist activity. And it's actually not even that 80% itself, not the profit margin. It's also not the money that's connected to that profit margin, the revenue returned from that profit, but actually the elasticity, the flexibility, the fact that it's made up, because more fluidity, more elasticity, more opportunities for arbitrage. So now we're going to start really getting into some examples. Think about NVIDIA, which everyone here obviously knows as the quote unquote hardware company driving the AI boom. So what does NVIDIA make? GPUs, right? The processing units that are required to do the hardcore multivariable calculus that ultimately is something like GPT-5 or Claude. But NVIDIA doesn't make GPUs, obviously. NVIDIA resells Taiwanese chips made by TSMC. They lease some intellectual property to TSMC in the form of like some licensing and some initial schematics. But actually, the real value add that NVIDIA is putting onto these chips is literally software. It's CUDA. It's the software framework that transforms these chips from the brains inside of video cards to the brains inside of generative AI. But that's also not really what NVIDIA is selling. Instead, a whopping, insane 88% of NVIDIA's revenue comes from its data center segment, which would make a lot of sense for the world's most valuable company, through which that 88% is like a huge chunk of the American GDP if NVIDIA actually owned and operated any data centers. But they don't. Instead, they provide licensing, certification, and ultimately a software management layer on top of data centers, which are also not actually run by these partners. These are called third-party colocation partners who themselves are just other software companies. And what they're ultimately doing is build another layer of management and then going to third-party partners who ultimately may own or at least lease a piece of land and then maybe lease access to some hardware, which is coming from another third-party location. And all of this bubbles back up in the form of management software, through which a company like NVIDIA is going to operationalize and ultimately lease and disburse the compute that's coming back upstream. So NVIDIA doesn't want to touch the hardware layer. They don't want the data center layer. They want to resell all of that ugly underbelly as and through software. So this is the second type of lift. Capitalism lifts away from the production and logistics of physical commodities towards the modular assemblage, licensing, and renewable capitalization of software. It's going to start getting weird now. So the next type of lift is from purchase to contract. So from selling something to entering into a contractual relationship. And you know something is getting lifted when you hear as a service, which functionally means a transformation from ownership or possession of a good into a sustained, renewable relationship built around contractual access. And this is actually a really, really old practice. In fact, one of the oldest economic practices, especially when dealing with depreciating hardware assets. Thinking about it in modern terms, don't buy a car, lease a car. Don't buy a jet engine from Rolls-Royce, lease what's called power by the hour. That's a concept that's been around for almost 70 years. Don't buy a GPU from NVIDIA, lease GPU hours. You can see the change in the unit economics from GPUs to GPU hours. You don't buy 1,000 copy machines from Xerox. You enter into a multi-year relationship, enterprise relationship, where Xerox will administrate your relationship to copy machines. And while this is useful in hardware economics, it's actually way more useful in software economics, where the underlying good isn't actually depreciating. So if you're an Adobe user, I see a lot of very artsy people here. Maybe I can imagine maybe some people purchased Photoshop, but most people stole Photoshop back in the day, right? So you used to actually be able to run Photoshop on your own computer, right? And that's cool because you had the actual ability to run something locally. You had a discrete connection to it as software, but something changed. And you could see exactly when that change happens in the graph, right? I mean, that's, they made a pretty fucking good business decision in terms of making the decision for you not to run this particular operation on your computer, but rather to run it on their own servers. Since they're ultimately paying for the servers, they're basically leasing you access to software that's running on their own servers, and they are allowed to therefore engage with you in a kind of long-term contract, maybe on a monthly basis, or maybe if you want to pay slightly cheaper, annual basis, right? And there's actually very, very few pieces of software that haven't made this transition over time. And you kind of know the way that you can really tell this is happening is when you're starting to engage with software, not through things that you install on your machine, but rather through the browser, right? Because the browser ultimately is a portal to a server where something is happening elsewhere, where that piece of software is running somewhere else. And so I can see like maybe there's some Ableton Live users, maybe there's some Final Cut Pro users or Adobe Premiere users here. Like these are pieces of software that for the most part, you can actually buy to a certain extent and run locally on your machine. But the transition to AI-driven software means that this is ending, actually, because even these tools are ultimately going to grow dependencies on software that's run on giant GPU data centers, right? And so they're going to have to pay some kind of renewable relationship to, you know, whoever's running those data centers, and they're ultimately going to have to pass that back to you. Like, total prediction, like Ableton is going to acquire some kind of subscription-based pricing as soon as they move into AI territory. Like, this is the moment where everyone who hasn't made that change yet is finally going to make it. And not because they want to, because they have to, because that's the only way that they can stay viable as a business, is to pass on those recurring costs. So instead of a single point charge from business to a customer, you enter into this long-term relationship monthly or annually or maybe several years in a row, which is really good for the business also because they can represent their finances in a speculative way. Instead of revenue, they think about what's called recurring revenue, which is revenue in the future as amortized into a kind of reflection on the present. It's not about how much money you actually have in the bank now. I don't know if anyone here works in the startup universe, but like lots of these companies don't know how much money they have in the bank now. Actually, answering that question is really complicated. What they do know is how much cash they're burning on a monthly basis, but they're not profitable entities. They fundamentally operate with a strong negative cash balance. No, instead, what matters is the money contractually guaranteed to you in the future. And what's even crazier about this is that the more of this speculative money that you have, the more you can actually use it as leverage for the further automatic reciprocal generation of more money. Oh, and this is another example from Brazil. I was just looking at Magalu, which is like transition from like a magazine company into like now just like a huge Amazon-like SaaS entity. You can see they offer themselves as Magalu as a service now, which is really beautiful. Next lift.
Yeah, the next type of lift is what we call managerialization, which means the transition of a business from an actual service provider into something that facilitates services handled by other people. This kind of lift is characterized by a movement away from customers or consumers. And here by a customer, we mean someone to whom a good or service arrives as a consumable entity. And that is the termination point of a chain of business relations, if you want. And the thing is that reaching that termination point is not desirable to exo-capitalism, because that's the moment when the ultimate price of a good becomes most compressed. It becomes real. This is the ceiling. This is the exit point. This is where the matter of value is actually settled. So the goal then becomes to transform from a business that interfaces directly with the consumers, a B2C company, if you want, to a business that really only engages with other businesses, a B2B company, and ultimately move as far away from the 2C link at the end of the B2B chain as you can possibly get. So what you get is a B2B, and finally 2C, which is us here. And we were like a week ago in Oslo, and we wanted to discuss some examples from the kind of Scandinavian business ecosystem. So we were talking about Nokia. So
I keep thinking to myself that like all the audiences that we're talking to like never experienced the Nokia cell phone.
Yeah, but I'm going to explain.
They did. Yeah.
So the first phone that I had when I was 17 was a Nokia, which was an amazing machine. It was, you know, late 90s. And that was, I mean, Nokia was a B2C company. They would sell cell phones. They got outcompeted by other companies that realized that the value was in software, So we are thinking about iPhones and the whole kind of Android-based community, Android. So they evolved from a phone maker into a sort of telco, and eventually they became a B2B provider of network infrastructure. That's what they are today. Another example that we use in Germany, that's because it was a bit closer to the ecosystem in a way, was Siemens. Siemens existed even when Marx was writing. And Siemens has gradually transitioned over the course of its entire life from a utility company to an industrial manufacturer, to an industrial process designer, to a factory automator. So over the past 50 years, they've been transforming the industrial world into what they call digital twins. Yeah. You might have heard that word for other things, but in this case, a digital twin is a one-to-one representation of a physical object in the cloud. Say that that physical object has a button on it, then there is a button that can be pressed through the cloud. Say that the physical object is, you know, getting like temperature readings, then you can do that on the cloud by accessing some sort of API system. Now, you may see the value here in terms of automation. Yes, where an entirely digitally twinned manufacturing line can be accessed, maintained, and optimized through remote digital interventions alone. Now, this is where we think that we're getting fooled. Like we we think everyone, most people, because we read intentions like this and similar intentions by Tesla as actual interests in manufacturing itself, in automating manufacturing in order to drive down the variable costs of production. And that is not what is actually happening here. Like Siemens is not doubling down on manufacturing. Instead, they are pivoting away from manufacturing. So what is happening is that instead of selling hardware to businesses that operate that hardware in a consumer-facing way, the goal becomes to sell digital twin software to businesses that then in turn sell their manufacturing capacity to other businesses that only at the very end actually end up selling hardware.
Yeah, capitalism has no interest in automating production or automating labor. We really believe that. This is the most depressing YouTube video I've ever seen in my life. If you can't read it, the subtitle is OnlyFans Management Consulting by Marcus Hussle. I don't recommend watching it, but you can see a lot of this kind of managerialization that we're discussing in the small business world. Like, this is not like only an enterprise kind of giant thing. It's actually really distributed in a very even way across maybe all of us, especially in the art world. I think there's a lot of this happening. But one of the best examples is the OnlyFans exclusive content creator. So the exclusive, I think this is so poetic, like the exclusive and exclusive content precisely and so beautifully names a transition from ownership of a magazine, a DVD, something like this, into contractualized leased access to essentially pornography as a service, right? And as the popularity of OnlyFans exploded, especially during the COVID pandemic, many creators found themselves running super viable small businesses. And they quickly discovered that the real money wasn't in the first party production of pornographic material, albeit for the, you know, top 0.1% of creators, but rather in starting to build advisory companies, dedicated OnlyFans management agencies for the heavy lifting of business, marketing tasks, and let's say helping other OnlyFans creators send messages to people. And so in turn, a kind of meta management business model has been cascading upward where you're seeing people coaching OnlyFans managers on how to create and sustain OnlyFans management businesses. And if you open up LinkedIn.com, I don't see a lot of very LinkedIn.com people in this room, but you should. I think it's like the most intense experience you can have. Like, I mean, it's like looking straight in the face of God. You know, it really hits you in the soul. You can really see the sprawl like this in real time, regardless of the business sector. So instead of operating a small business, let's create a management service for small businesses. There's way less risk in that. It's a way more kind of generalized activity. And then, you know, instead of doing that, why not create a management service for management services of small businesses? And then once you're ready, once you've established some clout, create a coaching service for management managers. And when you're ready to retire, create an executive coaching business to coach those coaches and so on. So the next type of lift, that was managerialization. So this kind of layer of generalization over top. This one is from transaction to integration. And this is like the real weirdness starts to ratchet. So we could talk about Shopify. We could talk about Alibaba. We could talk about Rakuten. All of these objects are not retailers. They're not malls. They don't buy inventory for the most part. They don't own warehouses for the most part. They're more like brokers and their platforms. They provide management layers for identity, payments, catalog, checkout, enormous partner app ecosystems. And what they ultimately do is they kind of take a cut of the revenue that's moving within these surfaces. And so this looks like a very aware crowd of what's been going on in the left recently, maybe, not to be too presumptuous, but you've probably heard the term platform capitalism. Like, that's what everyone is talking about now, platform capitalism. There's like a, it's like a consensus. Oh, is there, is Nick's
yeah, searches?
Yeah. So, I mean, super reasonable. But so there's a consensus within left adjacent critique that the way to understand the world right now is through platforms, but that platforms are really all about consumers. Platforms are obsessed with consumers, actually. They're obsessed with their customers, and their function is primarily to engage in social engineering to trap customers like spiders for a network effect, revenue, and external data sales. And like, this is kind of what happens when the discourse is kind of only thinking about social media, which is actually a really, really small part of the platform economy. And then for someone like Yannis Varoufakis, who we've been increasingly shitting on, like, we're getting more courageous now, but like, respect, whatever. But like, that perspective is even more extreme, because for people talking about quote unquote techno-feudalism, that's the other word of the day. That's like taking the platform capitalism position and like dialing it up to 11. Basically, the idea that platforms are actively evolving into micro-political environments, and they're so obsessed with consumers, they're so invested in customers, that they're literally intervening in their lives, vertically integrating into full-stack providers and sustainers of human welfare. And that just seems incorrect. Like, that doesn't seem like that's what's happening at all. Shopify, Rakuten, Alibaba, they get paid precisely when customers leave the platform. Platforms aren't vertically integrated worlds under the theory of exocapitalism. They're actually extremely porous and indifferent. For us, a platform is all about being incomplete. It's about surface area for integration. It's about partnerships, channels, and alliances through which a given platform provides as many management solutions as it is receptive to them. It's about fertility, longing.
Platforms are horny.
Yeah, very horny.
This is not dissimilar. You might think we're only talking about Europe, but Western reality here. And we would argue that this
we're
is not...
We're not at all. Yeah, totally.
This is not dissimilar to China's absolutely huge WeChat platform, which contains 20 million micro applications.
Can I ask, like, has anyone opened up WeChat before? Have you seen? WeChat is crazy. Can I just get like a WeChat is crazy? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's amazing. I mean, it's amazing. 20 million app ecosystems. That means that that application is able of hosting within its own like framework 20 million different business portals. It's crazy.
And all of those operate like pores or backrooms within the WeChat project. Yeah. So techno-feudalists would suggest that WeChat is actively invested in managing services like transportation, for example, vertically integrating itself into the physical life of its users in order to maximally extract from their attention. But we argue that this is not what is actually happening. For example, WeChat would partner with someone like a company like Didi to offer taxi services within a user interface that looks exactly like Didi's native application, just served up within the raw interface of WeChat. Then WeChat will collect a cut from both Didi and through its parallel partnerships within the Chinese state. And that's how it's actually operating. We will also argue that WeChat operates as a kind of hinge around the Great Firewall, capitalizing on its relationship with the Chinese state through its dual WeChat and Weixin structure. I don't know if you're aware of this. Weixin was first kind of established in 2011 as an internal reality. Then WeChat expanded as an external reality, as many other things did at the time. So that kind of sort of internationalization of the platform is part of what makes WeChat quite interesting. Because what WeChat is actually doing is it is providing customers outside of China with a heavily moderated backdoor into the Chinese internet, monetizing governance and regulatory complexity, arbitraging sovereignty itself. Okay, all of this seems quite recent, quite contemporary. So again, someone might argue, well, this is just a new form of capitalism we're trying to discuss here, although we're talking about the logic of capitalism, the internal logic, and thus the name does not should not be framed as such. But we also wanted to discuss examples from the past that, you know, serve to exemplify the argument that we're trying to raise here today. And one of those is, for example, the Champagne Fairs of the 12th to 14th centuries. And what we find here is that the Counts of Champagne built a B2B management layer, and they took tolls, rents, call fees, and exchange fees. And these were not just like platforms. They were actually lifted economic zones, mediating identity, payments, fulfillment, all through a sprawling partner ecosystem of Lombard bankers, notaries, carters, and so on. This platform was incomplete, and it was a porous kind of protocol to let the Genovese, the Flemish, the English, and the Catalan networks plug in and trade through it.
So I'm sure you've all seen various different representations of this chart. Actually, someone just sent me one that's the numogram right now, but with like all these guys, which is very funny. But this is a very, very important chart to understand the American economy, but is obviously a heavily multinational object. So the most advanced practitioners of what we're calling Lyft are able to operate at totally stunning removes from the actual service of transactions. So if you think about the relationship between Delta Airlines and American Express, or for our European friends, let's say MasterCard and the Star Alliance community, this is not a relationship of a business to a customer or even a business to a business. It's actually a kind of muddy commingling of multiple worlds, multiple platforms through which revenue moves in eddies and streams. American Express and Delta Airlines are obviously not the same company, but more importantly, they don't want to be the same company. In fact, the value occurs precisely from the fact that these are two different companies. Neither of them wants to be a monopoly that contains the entire world within itself. Instead, they want to be kind of like translucent films that cling to each other, that rub and flow together. And this is the contemporary monopoly. It's an omnivorous monopoly of sorts. And this is something that so few people, I think, understand that, you know, the idea of the monopoly, you know, as culturally constructed is something that wants to control a world or a market singularly. But instead, the type of monopoly that we have, that we talk about, is one of being open for integration with everyone, with everything, to have infinite surface area such that if two companies might compete, like Oracle and Microsoft in this diagram, or now AMD and NVIDIA, they're also totally flowing into each other, over each other, excreting and drinking revenue through each other. And to comment further on this slide, it's totally reasonable to think of a company like OpenAI as the company that's giving you ChatGPT, right? That's what we all think of OpenAI as. But the company itself rightfully considers ChatGPT to be a freemium marketing tool for its core business, which is large-scale, multi-year, enterprise romantic relationships, right? Wherein this or that large company is going to run their AI agents on OpenAI infrastructure. But even that is a marketing tool. Even that product is a superficial explanation of what's going on, because OpenAI is functioning much more like a securitization tool through which very, very large speculative capital raises with valuations based entirely on the AI hype produced through these marketing operations can then be absorbed and resold into other organizations within the broader Oracle, Microsoft, NVIDIA, AMD multiopoly. And I really just want to give you a sense of the scale of these operations. So, I mean, a lot of us went on Instagram.com and widely criticized OpenAI for its $200 million USD deal with the US military. And like, fuck the US military. Obviously, the US military is bad. Not a fan. Fuck the US. Like, I'm not a fan of these things. But I do want to make it clear that $200 million USD is 0.5% of the capital raised by OpenAI just so far this year, and 0.06% of its vendor contract that it just signed with Oracle. Could this not also be a marketing contact, marketing tactic? Oops, sorry. There you go. Yeah.
So let's move on. New type of Lyft. So from here, there is a Lyft from product to position. This is the moment a business stops making money on things and starts making money on stakes. And I'm sure we've seen a lot of this over the past few years. This is the moment where business becomes a bank.
Yeah, Jacobin Mag just stole our exact terminology here, but it's fair. Yeah. It's real.
So let us think about an example here. SoftBank, a Japanese company, began as like a software license manager and distributor. They would sell magazines with floppy disks inside. Floppy disks.
In a magazine. It's so cute. Like, yeah, it's amazing.
And they kind of leveraged that weird floppy disk company to borrow cash. And then they used that cash to finance speculative bets on other companies. essentially arbitraging the asymmetry between American software business valuations and their valuations in Japan. And this hit a local peak when SoftBank bet $20 million USD on Alibaba, year 2000. By the year 2014, that was $50 billion. And then they continued to place bets like this, and they eventually became a broker for the purchase and resale of other companies. And if you think about it, every hallmark logo of conventional industrial capitalism went through a similar transition. Yeah, we can think about Berkshire Hathaway's mid-century transition from textile milling into an insurance-powered capital float allocator, and then into an ambiguous multinational holding company. We can think of Hudson Bay's company's early 20th century transition from fur trading to real estate management. We can think on the late 19th century of the maturation of U.S. Standard Oil from refining into an ambiguous trust certificate management machine. And if you want to look backwards, you can also think of the Medici's in the 15th and 16th century and their state as a transition from cloth to multinational financial services. In each of these cases, and this is fundamental, the underlying goods became less and less relevant to the underlying source of value. Given its proportionally limited returns, scaling instead through the abstraction of the product, the reinvestment of capital into capital, back into capital, and the establishment of a reciprocal relationship within the broader plane of business as such. And this was actually a really common practice before the heyday of industrial capitalism.
This is not how you bet on the stock market, by the way. This is like bad stock market betting.
So a classic kind of 18th century example was the South Sea Company. After the war of Spanish succession, the British government had incurred a ton of war debt and issued a ton of IOUs to the providers it owed money to. And as part of a treaty that ended that war, the British government obtained a valuable license it could exploit to pay off that debt. And that was the permission to trade enslaved African people to Spanish colonies. So this is kind of fucked up. But what the British government proposed at the time was a relationship with the newly founded South Sea Company, where anyone with an IOU to the government could exchange that IOU for equity in the South Sea Company, who was going to be the company who would engage in British transatlantic slave trade. But the funny thing is that the South Sea Company didn't own any ships, have any destinations, or almost anything. It was more like an idea, a title on an idea, a really fucked up idea, if you want. And what happened is that those IOUs floated in, and the South Sea Company became huge. And not only that, they could reference the equity they had raised in order to sell new shares to pull in more money, essentially riding the financial volatility of their own stock, at the end of the day, ballooning, then popping, and then flatlining before they ever actually set sail.
You could also think about Starbucks. So Starbucks, you know, especially in the United States, like if you want to have a Starbucks experience at all, you really have to use the app at this point. And in order to actually use the app, you need to preload cash onto it. That's usually around 25 USD at a time. You can't just pay for coffee directly. You have to preload money onto the app. You use that money and you spend it down. And what's really beautiful is that that money is stored into the actual application itself as what are called stars, which is gorgeous because those stars are very really bucks. But what's crazy is that essentially you're lending money to Starbucks in advance of receiving any coffee. And as of earlier this year, Starbucks was sitting on almost 2 billion USD in stored value balances from customers. 2 billion USD means that they're in the top 20% of US banks. So this float is interest-free capital for Starbucks. They can happily reinvest that cash. They can use it for operations until someone redeems it. And actually, a lot of their customers never even redeem it altogether. And unlike a traditional bank, they don't have to pay you any interest. So not only are they one of the biggest banks in the US, they're like a really good bank, like in terms of their financial model. That's a pretty smooth operating structure. It's also worth saying that Starbucks is managerially lifted through licensing. So this is in the UK. 48% of Starbucks stores aren't actually managed by Starbucks. They're licensed to third parties. You know this kind of every time you walk into like a shitty kiosk and something like looks like a Starbucks, but like kind of isn't a Starbucks, like it's something-ish. So these licensed stores, they're doing the actual work of generating those reward points, those stars, those royalties, margin on the Starbucks supplied product and brand. But because of this relationship, all of that capital expenditure and the operating costs sit with the partner directly. So Starbucks gets to just monetize brands. They get to monetize software. They have a huge software engineering organization. They get to run recipes, for example, like intellectual property. But the others, the people that they partner with, are the ones that are actually running the leases and the payroll. And they don't even afford them the dignity of calling them franchises. Like, even that has like a kind of, you know, you can own a franchise. No, this is like an entirely, this is a relationship of licensing only. So like, is Starbucks a coffee company? I think Roberto would say, no, it's not coffee, but coffee is definitely involved, right? And it's definitely connected to revenue in some way. But I think we want to argue that it's not in its particularity determinative of revenue, because Starbucks is also a software company and they're also a bank. And what's kind of painful about this is that the only part of the business that's really struggling, the part of the business that's seen 4 years of revenue atrophy, is the coffee business, which is urgently attempting to rebrand itself at the moment. So if a business makes more and more of its money from being a bank, what kind of labor is relevant here? Is it barista labor or offshore third-party growers, or is it something else? So really, it's a question. What kind of labor is important here? But moreover, what kind of labor power is relevant here? And this is the problem, because actually, and in the case of Starbucks, the more friction that is applied by this or that material dependency, baristas, for example, the more the business attempts to retreat into higher and more generalized abstraction layers that contain more possibilities for alternative moves.
When we talk about the supply chain, it's easy to imagine the supply chain as a kind of long signaling vertical chain, but that's not the case. Yeah, it is instead a deeply interlinked array of lifting objects, each of which have secured multiple redundancies in terms of their downstream and upstream dependencies. A procurement agency can always automatically reroute to a cheaper or less problematic producer. The actual contents of the supply matter less and less in their particularities, and they certainly are not distinct or individual in any way in their ultimate relationships to revenue. Instead, they're fungible, they're interchangeable abstract vectors. But this gets so much more intense when we understand this through the perspective of Lyft, because not only does a produced good not only matter in terms of its particularity, but the connection between produced good and revenue itself is rapidly unspooling as each successive element of the supply chain also undergoes its own recursive nested lift. As you lift, you find yourself participating not in a commodities economy, but an economy of stakes, an economy of alliances, an economy of speculation, if you want, all of which are not only removed from the commodities economy, but are actually increasingly self-sufficient in that they capitalize purely on what Marx called fictitious capital. But fictitious capital to us is the only type of capital that is arbitrage.
So last type of lift here, and then we'll conclude. So this is the final type of lift, but of course there could be very many others. We're just kind of offering some dimensions on a concept. So this is from arbitrage on an asset, like the example of gold, like the price of gold, to arbitrage on something that thing doesn't matter. So arbitrage on numbers, basically. So Citadel is a huge hedge fund who is lifted from financial services to finance as a fully automatic money machine. Citadel Securities uses advanced algorithms to trade stocks, options, and other assets at incredible speeds, usually holding a position for around 200 milliseconds to a second. So the logic driving these trades, obviously, I mean, if they're holding the value of a stock for 200 milliseconds, they don't care how that business is going to do in the long term, right? It's for 200 milliseconds. They're not interested in the actual day-to-day or month-to-month or quarter-to-quarter business strategy. It's actually just based on looking at random deviations and exploiting tiny discrepancies in price, patterns in order flows, and other kind of statistical opportunities. They're harnessing randomness itself as a source of profit. And so there's a couple different ways you can do this. The most simplistic one would be to establish some correlation between different stocks or different options or futures. So we could look at stock A and stock B, or option A and option B. And let's say if option B has a correlation where it decreases when option A goes up, well, you might look at option B very closely and make a positive bet on option A, and that correlation may pay off for you. Reasonable. Or alternatively, you can take a ton of market data, feed into a machine learning algorithm, and then get a sense of how something might behave over time under certain conditions. But the problem is that even these operations are too easy for other people to do them. They're too, like, they're too specific. They're too real. Because if another person can run the same model, if another person can notice the same pattern, that means that a lot of people do arbitrage in the same place. So you get the market starts to clamp down and you get a regulation of price. Nobody gets to make a profit. And the easiest solution to this, which has been increasingly prevalent, is to use what I think is like the most poetic and beautiful term in finance, the dark pool. Which is like, these guys are real poets. Like, it's beautiful. And so in a dark pool, what you do is you essentially place a ton of different positions within a kind of black box. Like, I'm going to take this and this and this and this and this, sell this, whatever. And you also add a lot of noise, like chaff in like a World War II, you know, I guess more like a modern, where you're trying to dodge a missile, right? You like shoot out a bunch of noise to make the missile go in a different way. So you add like a kind of distracting elements all within this pool, and then you fire it out and it goes like... And it goes in and out, right? They just appear in the market and then they disappear. And the goal is that no one can really sense that they were there. But even that is like kind of annoying. Like that's too much work. It's ultimately not as profitable as they might like. So the better approach might just be to use straight up math to look at a totally decontextualized graph and make a simple inference based on random patterns. And this is like a kind of important thing to recognize about math, about randomness, is that like, randomness is not unpredictable. Like, it's actually very possible to make short-term predictions on random behavior. That's what the whole mathematical field of stochastics is. So in a lot of cases, when Citadel is doing this kind of stuff, they don't care about the long-term future of the asset. They don't care about who the asset is. But most of the time, actually overwhelmingly, they don't know what the underlying asset is because they're ultimately just making bets on mathematical probabilities. The content of the trades is irrelevant. They're generating profit simply because of the continuous fluctuation of the market. And if you trade thousands of times per second, even 51% chances, that's way better than casino odds, right? And if you're able to do that at scale, you can actually really capitalize on it. And what's important, I think, for a lot of people to understand is that even if the line goes down, that doesn't mean that people aren't making money. Like, people think that line goes down means that everyone's losing money. No, you can just take a short position. You can just place a put. Like, that means that I am basically betting that the price of this is going to go down. And you can make money that way. So it doesn't matter how the market moves. It just matters that the market moves. And everything underneath it, the machines, the human sweat, the blood stolen through colonial violence, the service workers whose passports have been taken away by weird para-sovereign entities, pharmacy workers, care workers, software engineers, HR managers, humming GPUs enhanced by slave-extracted neodymium, all of it, to the level of Citadel, bubbles up to the level of a random number generator, against which bets can be made simply through statistical inference.
So yes, this is where exocapitalism starts as a theoretical project with arbitrage as the kernel of capitalism, with the idea that corporate interest tends towards the liquid, the recurring, the independent, the recursive, the elastic, the fictitious. And it does so, it tends away from the soil, from the land, from the blood, from the sweat. And the argument here is that we're not trying to say that the soil, the land, the blood, the sweat are not real. And we're not trying to say that they do not matter per se, but rather that they only matter insofar as they consist in the actualization of a formal logic that can exist irrespective of that actualization. Much like how computation may exist without compute, or language, or mathematics, if you want, may exist without a human socius. If capitalism has its own independent formal logic, then looking at it only through its downstream actualization doesn't do the trick. It just doesn't explain our world. It's the kind of wrong way to go about understanding what's actually happening. And that's why we keep getting theories that conclude that capitalism has entered this or that new phase. And part of the argument here is that there is a calcification of liberal and even leftist thought around a strictly social critique of capitalism, a commodities-driven critique of capitalism, a kind of evangelical literalism of exegetic Marxian text, where actually the only way to understand anything is through its material conditions at the smallest possible scales. And ultimately, if capitalism is potentially pre-built into something like abstraction, representation, language, or even thought, then the question becomes what opportunities exist to contain, neutralize, or intentionally mobilize its excesses. Now, this is not to suggest that this problem is inescapable. And here's where we get excited about the responses to the book. We do not provide a solution. We don't believe that's our task. There's something dangerous about telling people what to do. We don't want to engage in that. We're not trying to start a cult here. But we are excited about the responses to the book. And over the past 2 weeks, 3 weeks, over the past month, since our beautiful publishers released the book 2 months ago, we've been engaging with people and we've received some responses that we think are interesting and we wanted to share them with you today. Only a couple of weeks ago, last week, we were at Oslo with Ruben Steinheim and Corania Remo-Klock, and they suggested that the issue might be crafting the appropriate sigil for capitalism, calling it by the right name, and therefore protecting ourselves accordingly. We were talking to all the people that you may know, Mohamed Salemi, director of the New Center, an artist also based in Berlin, Simon Denny, and they both suggested there might be some opportunity here to write these cancerous flows in really intentional ways. Others even suggested that maybe we have to reframe Marx's theory of value into one around volatility and volatility production. Others, this was a few days ago in Vienna.
I can't believe it was a few days ago. It feels like a year ago. But yeah, yes. So
at Erdstall. And they were talking about, coming from an anarchist kind of background, they would suggest that the focus should be on small-scale social autonomy and self-sufficiency. We talked to people like Hito Sturgill, who suggested that, and this probably resonates if you read Hito, that maybe the way to address this is to become utterly pre-linguistic, thoughtless, almost like egg-like. And then we also talked to other people, more kind of Landian, deeply Landian in their beliefs, like Max Valenci's, who was thinking of a more kind of violent solution to the problem that we may be raising here through the application of extreme social controls. But regardless, we are excited by the prospect of taking the question of escapability extremely seriously and examining the question through its most likely scenarios.
I just want to read, my friend Cole sent me a passage from Hume, who's obviously very unpopular for a number of different reasons, but it was it's a really nice passage on scale. I'm just going to read this. So with respect to reading capitalism exclusively through material conditions or labor, this is not what he's talking about. This is what we're talking about through him. Can a conclusion with any propriety be transferred from parts to whole? Does not the great disproportion bar all comparison and inference? From observing the growth of a hair, can we learn anything concerning the generation of a man? Would the manner of a leaf's blowing, even though perfectly known, afford us any instruction concerning the vegetation of a tree? So we also don't want to be understood. Like, we don't want to be suggesting to you guys that we think that capitalism is good, but we're also pretty morally indifferent to the question. And I think that this is where I think a lot of people get really stuck, that the calcified liberal or leftist position loves to engage in a kind of superficial moral conflict between absolute good and absolute bad, absolute big and absolute small, absolute innocent and absolute corruptive, absolute victim and absolute perpetrator. And then the bad, the corruptive, the perpetrator, they collapse into a kind of black hole, into a kind of de-differentiated singularity of evil. And we're not making an argument about not saying things are bad. Like, you can totally say things are bad, but rather for a true polytheistic pantheon of evil, one where different aspects of maybe our mutual enemies can be understood as avatars with different motivations, different abilities, and different dispositions. And in a lot of respects, we're falling from Kimberlé Crenshaw's intersectionality, which can be refracted or everted here into the idea that there exists great difference, albeit intersecting difference, within the spectrum of oppressors, just as there is great difference, albeit intersecting difference, in their experiences as oppression. But this book is not about oppression, which I think is actually what makes it a unique contribution to the discourse, but is instead a thought experiment about the internal mechanics of capitalism. There are many, many, many books you can read about the oppressive externalities of capitalism, a lot of really great ones. We're very happy to recommend a few. But, like the leaf, if we understand capitalism strictly and only through its capacity to oppress, we limit ourselves to an essentially reactionary position. No. If capitalism is your enemy, you should know your enemy. And you should understand your enemy not just through his tactical advantages on the battlefield, nor through the endless recounting of thousands of lost battles, but through an honest accounting of its motivations on its own terms. We so passionately believe that the question of escapability must first be met by a willingness of folks as cool and interesting looking as you guys to understand and engage with the otherwise arcane or maybe just tedious mechanics of capitalism, of finance. We've got to touch the hot stove. We suggest that instead of capitalism, our enemy is more likely scale. That underneath the unspooling, radiant logic of capitalism is the raw reality that humans are, and almost always have been, reproducing themselves at scale through slavery. And that this particular demon within our demonology should have primacy within our thoughts. We are in a situation where we already exist at scales that we do not understand, and all that we seem to be able to do is revert to the systems of mass enslavement that have been regulating human social reproduction at scale since at least the agricultural revolution. But we just talked to you for an hour, and that's like 2 hours, so we're not going to do that to you. We're done with this lecture. I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you so much for coming and having and listening to us, and happy to chat. You want some water? No.
Thanks for listening to the Ryle Books podcast. This episode was edited by Roz Del Olmo, and the music was composed by Eve. If you liked this episode, please think about subscribing to our channel. You can also find more of our past and upcoming events, as well as browse our collection of books via our website, www.ryle.space.